Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dev Propulsion Labs, the podcast about the business of developer tools. I'm your host, Victoria Melnikova. I'm the head of new business at Evil Martians, and today I am ecstatic. I don't think many people get a chance to sit with you like this in the room, so I'm very happy to introduce today's guest. Please meet Paul Copplestone, CEO and founder at Supabase.
Thanks for having me.
How are you today, Paul?
Well, if I had known that this was so professional, I probably would have had a shave and worn something nicer. But yeah, I'm doing great. It's nice to be here and cool that we can do this in person.
It doesn't get nicer than this, just so we're clear. Nice. You know, I put my best outfit today and yeah. Paul did too. And the reason why I'm wearing this is because we went to Supabase Select, which happened a couple of weeks ago. And I had a true kind of like fangirl moment. I really did. And I don't think you get to hear that often from women. Because, I mean, most of the builders, I guess, on Postgres are probably men. But still, I had a kind of like a pop culture moment at Supabase Select because you and Ant, you kind of held the stage the whole day and you had some amazing speakers, people that are probably inspiring to you as well, mm-hmm. you know, because they're leading generations basically of new builders and they kind of set a certain level of excellence in tooling and products that they build. And I'm sure it was a conscious choice who mm-hmm. you bring to the conference as speakers. So let's talk about Supabase Select.
Cool.
When did you come up with this idea and how did you choose the speakers?
I think everyone eventually aspires to have their own user conference. And for us, we have discussed it for many years and we kind of internally have a no conference policy, like as in we don't attend many conferences. Mm-hmm. We just put our heads down and do work. And then this year, for whatever reason, it wasn't me who chose it. The momentum built and mm-hmm. someone decided that now was the year. And I guess there was enough consensus built that we should do this. And then the idea really, it was a few people internally who have just done a great job. What had happened, though, I guess for my part in it, was I had been to the Stripe and the Figma conference.
Yes.
And these ones were in the Mascarpone Center, like at the same week, and then both opposite each other. Yeah. So I saw how cool these conferences were. Mm-hmm. And I especially loved Figma's because, you know, I was lining up and there were people turning up from all over the world and they're flying in and from Australia or from wherever. And they're all dressed, you know, their audiences, designers. Yeah, yes. And when you go outside, it felt like a festival. But it could have been something like that, a DJ playing. And I just thought, that's cool. Like it's a place for designers to get together and hang out. And I don't know how much they cared about hearing what everything was being launched, but why did people want to fly around the world to be part of it? And it's because their community is so big. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a way for them to give back to that community. And this is something we have, fortunately, a really nice community with lots of builders. And so a lot of the things that we wanted to do was capture that same vibe in our own conference. And in particular, we love the builder audience. Like what Figma did for designers, we wanted to do for builders, developers and builders, because I think the term is developer is becoming looser and looser. And so, yeah, for the speaker list, largely for me, I reached out to a few of the builders that I wanted to chat to mm-hmm. and ask questions about how they built their developer audience. So I was very lucky to speak to Patrick and Dylan, Patrick from Stripe, Dylan from Figma about their early days, Guillermo as well on Vercel and spoke to a few people like James from Firebase, which mm-hmm. was also very cool, just to share with our own community how closely we had collaborated in the early days.
It felt very handpicked. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's very rare to be at a conference where you have such a stellar lineup and you want to hear every single talk because it's just like, and you were asking questions yourselves. So that added like a very personal touch because I could imagine that you could have that kind of conversation with them somewhere else, you mm-hmm. know, not at a conference. And it was cool for me to kind of like be part of that experience. And it did feel very like niche and I don't know, just like really nice. It was one of the best conference experiences I've ever had. And I've been to many.
Oh, thanks.
So Congratulations. Thank and you. Obviously you made a few important announcements during the conference. When, if we talk about business side of things, it's interesting because you announced Multigrass, which is a big deal, and it means that you are pursuing bigger clients, right? Like enterprise. How do you see Supabase now with announced Series E? Mm-hmm. Like where it's going? What do you envision for Supabase in a couple of years, in 10 years?
We're very focused on data problems. And so we announced our Series E, and we did this round. And one of the things that we wanted to do as well was bake in a community round. Actually, I've wanted to do it for many years, but each time we raise it, then investors and lawyers say, ah, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of work, which it is. Actually, we'll, and you have some regulatory things that you have to meet. So probably like we'll raise only $1 million from the community to fly under the radar. And it'll probably cost us that much because we got to do a bunch of audits and things like that. So it's less about raising the cash from them, but allowing them, the community, to invest if they can. I would have loved to do it sooner so they get a better price. But to be honest, we're such a small org, a nimble org, that we haven't had the resources. So now, we're doing what we can, and hopefully it becomes a more regular thing. Let's see. We'll do our first one and see where we land. And then, using the money, we're still very much in this stage of the company where we want to build out a lot of this data platform and the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So like you said, we've got, a focus on the enterprise, but to be honest, also a big focus on a lot of our scale-up customers who get started with Supabase. This is our tagline, build in a week and scale to millions. And we do have these customers that scale up, within a week, they scale to 1 million users or beyond. Yeah. And they eventually hit the kind of upper limits of Postgres, which it's very scalable in Postgres, but when you start reaching its upper limits, you've got to do things to make it work and you've got to have a lot of handholding. And for us, we are a very PLG company, product-led growth, and we see a lot of that handholding exercise should just be product. And as much as we can, we're trying to build around the maybe limitations or the things that Postgres is lacking for now, and also contribute back as much as we can to the Postgres ecosystem so that others can use Postgres confidently, even at scale.
So if you think about Supabase as a product, there is Postgres, there's open source, and Supabase provides the service for people, right? That they can use this database and the power of Postgres without any additional kind of like brain work. If you think about the recent growth that happened due to this increase of vibe coding, this new kind of trend, do you feel like the product offering is changing as more of those people on board to Supabase, or is just part of the spectrum of people that are using and eventually they will become coders or like more serious builders?
We haven't specifically designed for like a vibe coding profile. One of the ways we thought about which profile to build for in the past was, say, if you take a spectrum of front-end developer to hardcore Postgres engineer, probably you want to be a little bit like 25% down the spectrum. And now the end of the spectrum has changed. So it's shifted out, not just like a front-end engineer who doesn't know a database. Now you've got a person who doesn't even know what front-end and back-end might mean, At the same time, what we were having to do in the past was, let's say we wanted to expose a lot of complexity in Postgres, maybe around row-level security policies or something similar, or how to write triggers. And what we were thinking of doing a lot was building a UI to kind of step people through, maybe a wizard-based approach, or like surfacing a lot of these unknown things through a nice user interface. And then we would also expose the developer to some SQL so that they were progressively learning SQL along the way. So a lot of people learn SQL using Supabase, which I think is good. It's kind of like a superpower. Now, the nice thing, even as the profile of developer has changed, so too has the way which we expose the tooling. So people are becoming very accustomed to a chat-based interface, which means that we could pull out a lot of these UI elements, and now we just have, say, a contextual chat and SQL. And these two modalities fit those two sides of the spectrum quite nicely. And again, they can get gradually exposed to SQL, and you can say, hey, I need to build a database for a library of my Pokemon cards or whatever it is that they want to build. And it can scaffold out this whole database schema for them, show them the schema before they run it, and maybe they just hit run, but at the very least they've seen it, they know that something's happening, it's not magic. And this is nice. They get as much as we can. We're trying to gradually expose people to the complexity that they have access to.
With my previous guest, we talked about Steve Jobs and how he talks about everything around us, that it's built by people and you can actually impact everything that's around you. You can build your own and you can create a new experience. You know, you can create new journeys for people even. As a founder, co-founder of Superbase, do you feel like you're impacting like thousands of lives? Like, do you experience that on a daily basis? Or it's kind of like, you know, we're just doing our work, no biggie.
I mean, there's some rare moments that I get out of my house and maybe I meet a friend who I met one when I was in Switzerland a couple of months ago, and he said, I hadn't seen him in a few years. And I said, oh yeah, I'm back into building another startup. Now he's from the startup world. And he said, oh, what is it that you're building? And I said, Superbase. He's not a techie. And he said, oh, I know Superbase. So this is very cool. Like suddenly my startup, which usually is too technical for non-technical audiences, is a bit more of a, I guess, household name amongst people who build. And that's nice. I like to see that it's solving it. A lot of what I'm motivated by is just solving the problems themselves. So I'm quite often out in the community online, just seeing what people have problems to solve. So as much as it is nice to have the recognition of say someone's using it, I actually get a lot more recognition seeing that they've got a problem and we can solve this problem or not. We do the best we can. And then actually kind of overcoming that problem, which could have been a challenge for them. So this feedback loop between hearing something, developing it, and succeeding to solve their problem, that's where I get a lot of my motivation.
What does your job look like day to day?
Yeah, it's a good question. It changes now day to day, where I used to be quite locked in and wanting to code all the time. It's now more of a liability if I'm coding, because I can't do any sustained work. It can be anything from yesterday, US East went down, takes down half the internet. And for this, maybe not everyone understands what that means, or people point out different things online and I have to, you know, correct the record on some things. So a lot of community management. Likewise, doing these things if I'm traveling, if I'm outside my office, or just catching up with the team. So a lot of our, this year we'll double our team, which is, we could do a lot more, but that's about the healthiest we can do it. And if we do less, it's also going to break things. So, you know, when you double in size, a lot of things change. You have to reinvent a lot of things quite rapidly. And that change is difficult for humans. A lot of the processes that you started even 6 months ago might not be relevant anymore or useful. And so you need to change them. And some of those things could be useful to a small portion of people, but not to everyone. Now it's really about trying to figure out how to navigate that within the org, because we need to grow. Our support tickets have grown 5 or 10x, and we can only grow the support team 2x. So it's finding a balance, and it's a difficult stage of any startup. I think any hyper, like anything that grows this fast, has this period, and doing it as gracefully as we can is one of the things that I think a lot about.
One of the things that you look for in people when you hire is low ego. And you also have a fully distributed remote team. Does that complicate things as far as the exponential growth goes?
a bit of both. I think I feel sorry for new joiners. It's very difficult to learn and know your colleagues when you're in a fully distributed team. And just for those listening, like, we don't have any offices. We've barely got meetings. Like, maybe one meeting per team per week is kind of the guideline. So you could, if you wanted, you can turn up to any meeting, but you could only do 30 minutes FaceTime with your team per week. And so it can be difficult to integrate into Superbase. At the same time, there are huge benefits. People can focus. There's no travel. You can work anytime you want and you just focus on results.
Mm-hmm.
For culture, especially where there's friction, there's benefits to everything being online. So for example, it's very hard with this many people. We've got people in 40 different countries now, I think. Yeah. And because we don't care where we hire from, we just, if the person's the right for the job, we hire them. But 40 different countries means 40 different communication styles. And so, of course, getting people to work together with different styles, even with the same style, can be difficult. The nice thing about it being online is you can quite easily course correct on people's communication styles because everything's written down.
Yeah.
If someone says something which can be perceived to be bad, they don't have to come to me and say, oh, they said this and they said it this way. And I have to go to the person awkwardly and say, hey, sounds like you said this and they misinterpreted. I can literally link them to the Slack thread and say, hey, just so you know, if you say it like this, it can be better. So there's just pros and cons. The most difficult, of course, is alignment across organizations. Like, we can't get in a room and talk about difficult problems. And so that's the challenge. And the way we solve that largely is trying to hire very senior people who look after their own roadmaps, do a lot of bottom up, and then very light on the processes. So making sure that we can adopt processes across the entire org with a few changes, a few tools as well, so that we're not scrapping over which tools to use and which teams, just trying to consolidate the basic stuff.
So let's talk about you and Ant. It's kind of crazy, right? So you are from the opposites of the world. Uh-huh. You met in Singapore, the two of you. He is from England. You're from New Zealand. Same language, but everything else is very different.
My wife would disagree on that. She's from France, and for her, we're basically the same culture.
You do seem very an organic fit for each other.
Yeah.
How did you find each other? How did that happen?
Yeah, it was really cool. We've actually, a few people in Superbase came to Singapore and we all lived together. The way that it happened was, for me, I did my first startup in Southeast Asia and it was across three countries, Singapore being one of them. And then after I wrapped up, I thought, what am I going to do next? And I was thinking of coming to the US, but my friend was recruiting for this thing called Entrepreneur First. And this is an accelerator where you get in a room, you meet 100 people, and then you start an idea. But it's all, I don't know if this is still the case, but at the time it was very deep tech. So things like space tech, quantum computing. I was working on virtual reality. So a very interesting group of people. And at the same time, Ant moved from, he got into Entrepreneur First and they said, well, you can do it in London or you can do it in Singapore. And he said, well, I want to do it in Singapore. That sounds awesome. So we both moved there at the same time and did the course together. He ended up doing a company through Entrepreneur First. And because I didn't think the idea was going to happen fast enough, the timing wasn't good. And we ended up moving in together in a hacker house where I think there were seven of us and maybe we were building six different companies. And then I built my second startup. And in the process, I was kind of building what is now the tech behind Superbase. And when I wanted to do it, I thought, all right, I want to go to YC. I want to build this database startup. It's something that I've wanted to do for literally over a decade because I really like Ant and he's such a good human. One of my key things was that I wanted to have someone that we would spend, you know, a decade working on this with. So yeah, I asked him and fortunately he said yes. And yeah, here we are. It's been, yeah, 5.5 years now.
So seven years left.
Yeah.
For the decade to complete. Like even going further back, growing up in New Zealand, is a startup ecosystem in New Zealand like active? Like how do you learn about that stuff?
I didn't even know what a startup was. I was going to present this at the Superbase Select, but I found an old email, I think it's from 2008 or 2009, where I had written to, I wanted to build this database startup and it's like, I'm going to build it for developers and you can both design and develop the database at the same time. It'll be very visual, mm-hmm. basically describing Superbase, what it is now. And I had sent this email to just someone who I knew was a very rich tech entrepreneur, like kind of pitching him the idea, and he quickly shot me down. Or said like, that's, no, I don't want to fund it. But at that stage, I didn't know, I knew entrepreneurship because my father's an entrepreneur, but I didn't know of the startup scene and that you could raise money and venture capital, any of these things. I just wanted to build. So it wasn't till many years later that I tried to get into the scene. And then that's when I moved, like I moved out of New Zealand and I met someone eventually who, for my first startup, was the CEO, and he needed someone to do the tech. So I moved to Kuala Lumpur to do that.
I also wanted to talk about marketing a bit because, so, I mean, Superbase is famous for tech marketing. Some people would even say that you originated the culture of launch weeks. And I don't know if it's true, actually. Probably yes, right? Like you were probably one of the first ones to do this and to give it a name.
Mm-hmm.
Launch week as a concept is something that you started intentionally, or it's just like you found out that it works for Superbase, you made kind of like a concept out of it and gave it to the world?
Yeah. And that website, by the way, is maintained by one of our communities and he's doing a really great job. We thought about using the name launchweek.dev to kind of for ourselves, but then I realized, oh, it's so much nicer if he wants to use it and he does a newsletter. And yeah, so if you want to follow along with all the other developer tool launches, it's worth checking out. The way it happened was that we kind of got this culture of Kaizen. It's from the Toyota production system where you just do continuous improvement. The idea is from the CEO to the assembly line worker in mm-hmm. Toyota production system. So incremental changes all the time. And so what we did was we did a couple of launches during YC and mm-hmm. then we saw how successful each launch was for the kind of slope of the curve. Each time we did it, we grew a little bit faster. When we got out of YC, demo day was such a good forcing function for us. We had mm-hmm. this thing in front of us and we wanted to ship. So we said, all right, let's just emulate our own, like let's just set a date in the future and we'll try ship something then. So we just ship. And then what we did was we went from alpha to beta on that date. Nothing really changed except for that tagline, alpha to beta. Again, the slope of the line changed just because we kind of announced, we put down our developer hats and we picked up our marketing hats. So then we thought, all right, this is working. How do we do it a little bit better, just in a Kaizen manner? And we said, all right, let's try to ship one thing every day for a week. Instead mm-hmm. of one launch, let's do 5 launches. And we came up with 8 things. And, you know, even if we end up only shipping 3 things, then it's better than one thing. So in the end, we got those 5 things out and we called it a launch week because we had 5 things. And from there, we just continued doing them because we saw again that it was very mm-hmm. successful.
Does it still work for Superbase?
It does. If nothing, so nowadays the slope of the line kind of takes care of itself and there's many other things that affect it. The main thing that I think why we do it internally now is because it's still a good forcing function. We don't put timelines on our team. We have this concept of fixed timeline variable scope. So we like if people want to ship something, it's less about what they ship and when they ship. What like we've got this launch week coming up. What do you want to ship? And they'll try do it. But if it misses it, you shouldn't just ship because it's half baked and we set that date. All we care about is like, you've got a bit of momentum or mm-hmm. pressure to organize things. And also if you leave developers unchecked, they probably will just keep shipping and never announce what they've done. So it's nice for them to come up and take a breath of fresh air and, you know, chat to the community. And we even do things that aren't that successful in launch week. Like our Twitter spaces maybe only has like, say, 150 people turn up or something like that, or maybe 100 people turn up, which by the absolute size of our company, you'd think maybe we'd get thousands of people turning up. That's not what it's about for us. We just, if we see it grow each time and the developers are chatting to the community and they're also practicing how to, you know, be a more product-minded engineer, all of these things are useful, not for the outward-facing thing, but just to build a more holistic organization.
And I remember the last time we spoke in like a few years ago, I told you that I'm a huge fan of memes. Like I die for it. It's my thing. And you mentioned that it's Ant's responsibility, right? It's his domain. He's the boss. And he did that on stage too.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, now I believe it. Now I believe it. Is it still his domain?
Yeah. They do workshops together. Meme workshops. but yeah, I mean, it's very hard to hire for that type of
profile. Could imagine. AI is not.
No, AI is terrible at memes. I mean, you can use it to generate some content, but not the, you know, memes are, they're really one of these ineffable type of things. You don't get why you get it, but it's like stand-up comedy. You can practice a little bit, but.
So you do workshops, internal workshops.
And runs them, yeah. Well, them and the marketing team. I assume we've got a lot of good meme people, and we do have a very, our Slack threads are very organized. So they're all namespaced and things. So like external or like admin or whatever it is, teams. And there's only a few that don't have organized names, and that's our water cooler and our meme channel. These are the two where you can kind of, they're a bit more freeform.
So you and Ant, you kind of split responsibilities between each other. And you mentioned that at a previous startup, you were a CTO and now you're a CEO, which is a more, I guess, business side role. How do you split your responsibilities now? Like, do you feel like you complement each other with your skill sets?
Yeah, we're very complementary. And we have a lot of overlapping ones where, you know, we both have opinions on stuff, but maybe the other one can make decisions. And we've got other people as well that I would see as co-founder-like who also have complementary, and their opinions are very important to us. And even like the early employees, we've just got so many of these because we hire a lot of ex-founders whose opinions like I value above my own and a lot of the things that they're doing day to day. Yeah, I guess we have a very flat org, and between Ant and myself, maybe our titles don't really reflect our day-to-day job. So maybe he looks after a lot of the marketing, of course, and also a lot of the hiring and a lot of the culture as well. And that's where maybe we overlap. Culture is one that's important for many people, just especially if you're a co-founder, even the way you behave is going to seep down whether you like it or not as part of your culture. For me, working with people internally, if and when I can, and if things are, there's a lot of friction. And then I am particularly interested in product and strategy, making sure that we're building for the next 5 years and trying to skate where the puck is going on the product side, working with customers who have had friction around Postgres. And then, a lot of the community stuff, especially when things are, I guess, more in crisis mode, then me as a CEO, I should be focused on taking on that responsibility as well. And then fundraising, of course, some of these business things and hiring leadership are, a bit of both on the side.
Yeah. So you kind of take pride in hiring ex-founders, and I understand why, you know, and you talked about it at Superbase Select also, hiring people that can pick a domain and be in charge of it and kind of like take it almost like high agency unit within the org. How does that combine with a low ego? Like founder and ego seems to be like, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess controversially, they probably should not conflict, but I can see why like it might be seen. First of all, you know, if a founder wants to join Superbase, you know, not as a co-founder, then probably, like, if they don't, it's a self-selecting thing, if you see what I mean. Like,
yeah.
You want to no longer be a co-founder. You don't want to be in the limelight. And I think a lot of the people who join who were founders realize that it's not that glamorous. Like, to be honest, I wouldn't mind, after Superbase is done, going working for someone else and spending 40 hours a week just developing product stuff.
Would you join Superbase?
I would love to join Superbase, yeah, and just do that.
Yeah.
It's not as glamorous as it seems to, and you are the face of things, but that matters little, actually, when there's a lot of purpose to be found in just solving a problem and doing it right. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of the successful, super successful founders no longer want to work. So it's less that type of founder mentality, and a lot more who might have, you know, been grinding for the past 6 years and couldn't find product market fit.
Yeah.
And there's something special about that type of profile joining, because by necessity, their ego's been beaten out of them.
Yeah.
Anyone who's done this grind, me, I've had to do this, and it's hard. It's probably one of the hardest things in the world to find product market fit and grind on it for many years. And you can have the best product, the best team, and sometimes just the timing and your luck does not go your way. In this time, Superbase had a lot of luck, and, you know, we have a phenomenal team and we have a great product, but, you know, the timing was just right. And so there's nothing to say that, like, someone else couldn't have captured this opportunity. For this time, we did. It's nice that we can share that with other ex-founders who come in, realize, you know, they appreciate the up and to the right charts much better than someone who's coming from a FANG startup and they kind of, they're used to, you know, billions of whatever every single week, whereas the person who's been grinding for a long time come in and they appreciate the opportunity so much more because they've realized how lucky it is to be in this position.
It's interesting you bring me to this point once again with Vibe Coding, because it's kind of like a phenomenon that we see with Bolt, you know, and we've been working with Stack Blitz for, I don't know, a few years, like 4 years. And I remember this moment when Bolt started taking off, and we even had like a shared Slack channel, and I'm like, is a Superbase button coming? And you're like, yeah, we're working on it. And I'm like, this is super exciting. But the reason why those companies chose Superbase to be the number one database for their products is kind of a mystery. Like, was it your personal network reaching out to them, or was it just the state of Superbase for the moment when this uprise happened? Like, what was the reason why Superbase became that number one default option?
A lot of Superbase's success is just focused on building a good platform. And one of the ways that we build a good platform is we try to make it extremely integratable. Our API is consumed by our front end. Our front end then, you know, the API team have to design it in a way that can be accessed by integrations. We also settle on standards, like Postgres is a standard. We were a complete product. We knew that the AI we had been building for AI for many years at that stage, where, like, we had been testing things out and consuming it and focused on what would the next wave be. So it's probably a series of things. And I know, for example, they actually tried other platforms and didn't have as much success at getting the LLMs to build with it. So, you know, even just the fact that we had a burgeoning community that had discussed what works and what doesn't work online in Reddit, on GitHub, and we, you know, even put our troubleshooting guides on GitHub so they're consumable. Lots and lots of small things that eventually led to a moment where it was, I guess, just designed for the right moment, the right point in time. So, yeah, again, like, luck is a funnel that you try to widen as much as you can. And in this case, we were lucky that they chose us. I feel very fortunate that they settled with us. And it's been a great boon to Superbase to have them consuming us and lots of people throughout this year building on top of Superbase. But yeah, full credit to the team for designing it in this way where it can be consumed and integrated with, even if you're building a platform on top of us.
So there is this opinion that the vibe coding bubble is going to burst, you know, that is just like this trend, it's hype, whatever.
Yeah.
But in, you know, in a couple of months, in a year, it's going to kind of like go down. Do you feel like that's true? Or do you think that AI in general is making building more accessible to people who don't necessarily have coding skills?
Of course, like when you see the debates online, they lack a lot of nuance and they just think, oh, bubble and that's it. Vibe coding is here to stay. That's one thing that I can tell from my interactions and what we see. The form in which it might happen in the next few years and maybe the pricing mechanisms around it and like how it interacts with, say, existing code bases versus maybe as a prototyping.
Yeah.
All of these things are where I think the discussion is much more fruitful. I think, you know, vibe coding at this stage, I've talked to product officers at very large companies and they love these tools and they're able to do things that they previously couldn't and they get more velocity from their entire org because they can build things and show off things and make videos. Now, will it be able to attach to a huge code base? I think then we're going to see a lot of these two worlds merge a little bit where the vibe coding tools need to sit on top of existing enterprise workflows. And likewise, these workflows will probably want to pull in a lot of more of this, say, AI-based prototyping and developing and maybe even developing features or testing or whatever. So I think the form, like this idea that it is one thing here and will this one drop away and like we'll go back to being software developers and that's the only way the world will operate in the future of the bubble burst is a bit naive. So I've got some more nuanced theories around how it might look in a few years, and which is basically trying to mesh these two worlds together. And so, yeah, whether the bubble bursts or there's a correction around some of the economics and the companies is a valid conversation around maybe the economics of it and who's going to use it. But I think that the trend is here to stay and there will be winners in this space for sure.
Does your vision of Superbase, like let's say in 2020 when you started Superbase, could you imagine this, what's happening today for Superbase? Or was it always your plan to be like that big, to have millions of users? And you were just like looking for the right opportunity.
Our thesis at the start was pretty simple. We wanted to build a database company. And if you look at what almost every database company has done in the past, say 20 years, generally they build a new database, which is bigger and better, and then they try to migrate people to it. And it's not a bad idea building a new database, which is bigger than and better than some other incumbent one. That actually it works in a lot of cases. What doesn't work is migrating people to it because it's very hard.
Sticky.
It's very sticky. And the only company that I've seen do very well in this case, well, maybe two, were both Firebase and MongoDB because they focused on a new trend, something that changed. And they also were very good, especially at the start with MongoDB, at getting in on greenfield workloads. Yep. And then it turns out if you can do this over the course of a generation, then you become the generation's database and you earn the right to have the large databases. And so we knew that if we were to build the largest database company in the world, you know, you want to take on the giants. It's not to go head to head with them at the start. We're going to be in this for building for 30 years, you know, and we need to build out some of the incredibly hard systems that we're starting to develop now. But we've earned that right by focusing on these new workloads. We've launched 10 million databases. We have 5 million developers. Like these are the things that we have now earned the right to like it's ours to lose at this point.
I have so many questions and I'm kind of torn because I want to ask personal questions, you know, like for example, is there a work-life balance for you? Like do you have a life, you know?
Yeah.
Because running a startup, especially a successful one, is a big, big job. And I also want to kind of get this opportunity to ask you for advice for aspiring founders, you know, because I don't want them to feel like what they're working for is stripping away the balance from life, you mm-hmm. know? So I'll ask both questions then. Yeah. Is there a work-life balance in your life?
Work-life balance is slightly harder. I think, yeah, building a startup is a lot of work. At some point, you can add more leadership, which diminishes the amount of time you have to spend in the team, but not necessarily all the stress. There are always different problems. And so, yeah, it's definitely difficult, but it becomes easier as you hire good people.
Mm.
That's one thing that I think now we're in the stage where we've just got very good people who we really trust. The camaraderie makes it much easier to do. And having a good founder, a co-founder like Ant, is incredibly important for the staying power of to do this for the next 10 years, you know? So I'll be honest, no, there's not a lot of work-life balance. And maybe you have to choose one or two things that you can do outside of work. And yeah, commit yourself to those things so you do have something outside of work. But yeah, you've got to work hard and smart. Yeah. Yeah. I will say that I probably worked harder on my first startup than I did on this one. And it didn't succeed. So it's not necessarily that you work hard and suddenly that's the thing that makes you successful. There's many things that you have to do right. Working hard is one of them, but it's not the major thing.
So if you were to talk to somebody who is about to build, mm-hmm. let's say you yourself, I don't know, when you met Ant at mm-hmm. that time, what would be this opportunity that you feel like is a good opportunity to jump on? What would you advise to pay attention to?
Today?
Yeah.
That is an incredibly difficult question. I don't know if I wasn't doing Superbase, I don't know what I would do today, quite honestly. You need to action creates information. So I'd probably start something. And I've got two minds here. Like mm-hmm. often I have conflicting ideas, which you just live with. So the one conflicting idea is that really if you raise a lot of money on an idea that is not yet proven, you tend to behave like a startup without being a startup. And this is something that I did learn in my previous startups. You have to behave at a stage-appropriate manner. At the same time, I think it's stupid to sit out a bubble. We never do. If money is available and you can capture it, take it. But you should still behave appropriately for your stage. If you want to do some AI startup, take it. But then don't go silly on the first idea. Really, you've got to hone in and find that product market fit and build towards that before trying to do the blitzscale. Yeah. Strategy.
So when you found product market fit at Superbase, was it right away? Was it that Hacker News post?
Yeah. Product market fit people feel is like a one thing. I feel like there's many stages of product market fit. So in the first one, we repositioned from real-time Postgres to open source Firebase alternative. And that was 3 months in or something. And then we could see, you know, there was strong, strong interest, but not necessarily a lot of signups because the platform wasn't ready. And then we launched Auth, and then we could see some growth. It was growing organically at PLG. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I feel like we did things throughout the journey, which again, changed the slope of the curve and really trying to find what are the things that we need to add to gain product market mm-hmm. fit. And it's not always intuitive what those things might be. People might be asking for things and you think, oh, I need to add this and that will solve everything. And you add it and it might not do anything or vice versa. And sometimes, I was talking to an open source maintainer today about this one. Like sometimes we've added things and we might not see much usage of mm-hmm. that thing, but the fact that it's there made people feel like we're a more complete product. So it's a very hard thing to know, like what you need to do to get product market fit. But a lot of it's just listening to your customers, knowing to tease out what is the noise and what mm-hmm. is actually the signal and not believing everything that they say. But eventually you just feel that things are, you know, you go to sleep at night and you wake up and things are bigger in the morning.
So it's actually like you can't second guess it. when it's product market fit, you understand.
I feel for us, like, you know, maybe at each stage, I would say it's product market fit, but every 6 months, it feels more confirmed, you know? So there's definitely a stage where it feels like it's de-risked, but the feeling of product market fit definitely solidifies more and more as you continue, and you continue to get more feedback and iterate on what the customers really want.
So we arrived at my final question, which I call a warm fuzzies question. And I think I even asked you last time, I'm not sure. So what makes you feel great about what you're doing today?
I guess people wouldn't say this, but like, or probably shouldn't say this, but I'm quite proud of the team we've built and the people that they are. And I think it's hard to build a team where, you know, you have a lot of good humans and that, you know, are really focused on building. And pride isn't always seen as a great thing. But if there's one thing, and as well, like really a lot of this has to do with Ant as well, but we've just focused on keeping good people. And I like that. It makes me want to turn up to work every day and solve these problems for customers sometimes who are a little bit unreasonable, but you know, it makes it so much easier that we've got a group of people that are all in it together and we're kind of working on these hard problems together. So I think that's my warm fuzzy answer.
Lastly, I want to provide stage for you to invite people to try Superbase. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners know how to do that, but if they didn't, how could they find Superbase?
Yeah, if you want to attach a database or a backend to anything, then you can just go to superbase.com. Or if you just want to follow along and self-host it, even, we're happy with that. Or get involved in the open source community. We're always looking for more contributors, and we've got a team that can help contributors get started with getting involved in the ecosystem. So there's many ways to get involved. And yeah, I think if you're a builder and you've got any feedback on our product after you start using it, the easiest way to get in touch with me is just DM me on Twitter. And yeah, I love hearing customer feedback. And if we can fix your problems for you, then it makes it better for everyone using the product.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Paul. It's a pleasure to have you here. And we are super excited about Superbase future. I'm still like ecstatic after the Superbase select, and I hope that lingers not only for me but for your users.
Thank you
for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs. We at Evil Martians transform growth stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open source products. If your developer tool needs help with product design, development, or SRE, visit evilmartians.com/devtools. See you in the next.